Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. I've read a lot of books on Black history in America, along with numerous articles in magazines and newspapers over decades of continued learning. I've compiled much research data and watched many films and documentaries. I have so many recommendations, they could fill a library. But if I were compelled to narrow such recommendations down to three must-read books as part of a canon of American history, I would absolutely recommend W.B. Du Bois' seminal work titled Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880, followed by Dr. Martin Luther King's 1964 book on the Negro Revolution, titled Why We Can't Wait. And the third recommendation is a book written by my next guest, Elaine Weiss. The book is titled Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Welcome to the exchange, Elaine.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'm a firm believer in the power of storytelling, and your book reveals a powerful backstory of the rise of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s by connecting the dots of historic people, places, and events to a single school on a mountain that became a catalytic training ground for what Dr. King would call the Negro Revolution. And I'm thrilled to have you on the Jefferson Exchange to discuss your extraordinary book. And I'd like to start our conversation by learning more about you. Where'd you grow up? How'd you become interested in storytelling and journalism?
Well, thanks, Mike. I actually grew up in New York City, far from the places I write about in Spell of Freedom. But I trained in graduate school to be a journalist, and I have been a journalist all of my working life and worked mostly in magazines and in public radio. So the idea of storytelling is kind of comes naturally to me because that's what you do in those media. And my books are political because I am interested in reporting political events, but they are rooted in the past. So I don't have a PhD in history, but I take the research very, very seriously. And I work in primary sources, and those are very powerful sources for any writer. And when you see the original papers, you see the letters that are written by the characters you're writing about, you see how they underline, if they're handwritten, they underline certain things or they scratch out certain things. I find that really thrilling. So sometimes I talk about the narrative histories that I've written, and this is my third, as journalism with dead people. It's kind of facetious, but I do approach it as you would a story, with background, with character, with a narrative arc. So that's the way I approach writing history. And I know there are many ways to write history, but when you look at narrative histories, and that can be, from a whole range of authors, many of them are trained as journalists because there are a lot of transferable skills.
Well, your book does something that I find extraordinary, but rare. It ties together the disconnected dots of historical knowledge that many of us have been exposed to into a comprehensive and cohesive storyline. And now we've learned about the landmark Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board. But few of us know this incredible backstory that you provide with a through line from the decades leading up to it and the decades following it that produced a struggle that continues today. How did you decide to tell this story and how did you prepare?
Part of my preparation was that my previous book was about how American women won the right to vote. It was about the last stage of the suffrage movement and the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And most of that story takes place in Nashville, Tennessee, which was the last state to have to ratify. So in the Woman's Hour, I talk about race and suffrage and expansion of democracy. And this, I realize that the next great suffrage battle for the United States, the next opening of the franchise, the opening of our professed dedication to democracy, which we don't always practice, was the regaining the right to vote for Black citizens, especially in the South, because the 19th Amendment, though it was, it did provide for voting rights for all women citizens above the age of 21, which was the voting age at the time in 1920. In the Southern states, Black women were still prohibited from voting by a series of measures. And I realized that that gap, I wanted to explore what happened in between 1920 until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I found that, of course, the work, the struggle to regain the vote was ongoing. And, of course, Black men had been prohibited to exercise their constitutional right to vote, which was provided by the 15th Amendment in 1870, and it was taken away from them by Jim Crow laws. And that's included literacy tests, poll taxes, physical intimidation. And I realized that this story, I came upon the story of the Highlander Folk School in the mountains of Tennessee, which you mentioned. But I also saw that the Brown the Board of Education case in 1954, when it was decided by the Supreme Court, wasn't the beginning of the struggle by any means, but it was a galvanizing moment. And so I begin the book there. And in my research, I found that my characters were actually involved in that case, even though we sort of think of it as originating only with Oliver Brown in Topeka, Kansas, because that's the name on the case. Right. But it's actually five cases bundled together, all of them brought by the NAACP to challenge segregation in public schools. And they come from five different localities. And one of them was in South Carolina. And three of my main characters actually are NAACP activists in South Carolina. And also it involves a fascinating white federal judge in South Carolina, J. Waddies Waring, who rules from the bench against Jim Crow structure of oppression and really breaks the architecture of Jim Crow in South Carolina. And his dissent in a case that originates in South Carolina called Briggs v. Elliott becomes one of the cases that goes to the Supreme Court, is bundled into Brown. And the dissent he wrote when he had that case in South Carolina is used as a rationale by the justices in the Supreme Court decision. And so you see my main characters who have all been working towards a more equal society in their home states of South Carolina, coming together on this Tennessee mountaintop.
I want to get
about
to that.
What they could do.
I want to get to that in just a moment. My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's the author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. So you introduce us to these Black characters at the outset, and many of us probably have never heard of these names, such as Mrs. Septima Clark, her student, Esau Jenkins, and the beautician, Bernice Robinson. And then there's this white couple, Miles Horton and his wife, Sylvia, who were instrumental in their role of empowering and equipping Black and white activists alike. And through these people, we finally get to meet Rosa Parks, John Lewis, Dr. King, and other recognizable names. But Mrs. Septima Clark plays a pivotal role. Can you talk about her?
Yes. Septima Clark, sometimes it's pronounced Septima, was a Charleston school teacher, elementary school teacher. When the book opens in 1954, she's 56 years old, and she's been fighting Jim Crow all her life. She's on the executive board of the NAACP chapter in Charleston. She's been involved in court cases. She's deeply, deeply disturbed by the society she has to live in with its restrictions, its oppression. She's taught in these poorly equipped black schools because black teachers can't teach in the white schools, and of course black students can't attend the white schools. And she is very disturbed by the fact that things haven't changed quickly enough. But the Brown decision gives her a sense of hope. And so she, at the suggestion of another activist friend in Charleston, where she works and grew up, she goes to this Highlander Folk School. And there she sees for the first time that the world can be an integrated and more equal place, because at this Highlander School, everyone can eat together and live together. And so she comes back. She actually is incredibly brave. She's taking stances that are unpopular, not only with the white establishment, but even with her colleagues, her teacher colleagues, her family, because they know it's dangerous. They know that the fist of white law could come down on them at any time. And so they're very nervous about her being out there and advocating for rather considered radical ideas like integration and voting rights. But when South Carolina outlaws the NAACP as a subversive organization, which they do in 1956, and most of the southern states do something similar, she refuses to renounce her membership in the NAACP. She refuses to bow to this pressure and this smear campaign against the NAACP. She says, no, I won't resign. And she's fired. She's fired from her, she's been teaching for 40 years, and she loses her pension also. And she pivots and basically helps found the modern civil rights movement. And that's what the reader goes along with her on this journey.
So this was a real risk that she took. But her white counterparts also took risks. The Highland School seems to be the central location and training ground for collaborative activism between black and white people. Talk about the establishment of the Highland School and the challenges they faced.
The Highlander School was called a folk school because it's based on a type of community education institution in Europe. And the founder is this fascinating man named Miles Horton, who is a son of the Cumberland Mountains of Tennessee. Family were poor, they were sharecroppers, but he gets a college education. He goes on to graduate school, theology school, studies sociology at the University of Chicago. He's trying to find his place, and he comes across the idea of these folk schools, which basically bring communities together to discuss their common problems, social problems, economic problems, political, and brings in their cultural heritage to make them have a sense of pride in their community. And then they talk about communal solutions and then a plan to implement them. And so Miles Horton brings this idea back and establishes a tiny little outpost in the mountains of Tennessee, about 50 miles from Chattanooga. And it's remote, and it is in a county which has sundown laws, which means black people cannot be on the streets or the roads after sunset. And he defies all this. He thinks segregation is a great cancer on the body of the South and corrupts the soul of the nation. And he refuses to abide by Jim Crow laws and the state laws of Tennessee. And so the Highlander School is always integrated, which is, again, against the law. But he's just proud of it. And he's investigated by the FBI. The sheriffs are always lurking around trying to disrupt the educational process there. It becomes a, Highlander becomes a training center for labor organizers during the Depression. It's founded in 1932, depths of the Great Depression. He works with miners and factory workers and helps them organize.
Elaine, let's hold it. Let's hold the story right there. We need to take a short break.
Sure.
My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's the author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's the author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Before the break, we were talking about the Highlander School and its impact upon a lot of the activists that it trained. Can you continue?
Around late 1940s, early 1950s, Miles Horton, the founder of the Highlander School in Tennessee, recognizes that the South won't be able to make progress until they reckon with the racial situation and begin to understand how corrosive segregation and other oppressive nature of Jim Crow society are. And so he pivots the emphasis of the workshops he runs for community leaders at Highlander to civil rights advocacy. So he brings in Black academics and Black press editors and also just community leaders from across the South to come to Highlander for a week or two, live together with white people who are sympathetic to the idea of breaking the back of Jim Crow. And they talk and they deal with real problems, real issues, real obstacles that they're going to face. Miles Horton said he was very proud that Highlander was one of the only places, perhaps the only place in the South where Blacks and whites could truly talk together and could, as he called it, tea and pee together, meaning they ate together, the same tables. They lived in the same dormitory rooms. It was true integration. And for many of them, including Septima Clark, including a activist from Montgomery, Alabama, who arrives at Highlander in 1955, very discouraged about the lack of progress there. Her name is Rosa McCauley Parks, and it is at Highlander. It's the first time she ever eats with white people at the same table. It's the first time she feels comfortable talking about race among white people, too. And though she's very shy and she doesn't want to talk the first several days she's there, Septima Clark goes to her room and coaxes her and says, you can be safe here. And 4 months later, after she leaves Highlander, Mrs. Parks refuses to give up her seat on that bus. And she credits Highlander with giving her the strength to do it. She had seen a vision of what society could be like, and she wanted to achieve it.
That's interesting because she was not the first to do so.
No, she was not. In fact, one of her NAACP Youth Council students, Claudette Colvin, was 15 years old, also had refused a few months before. But she was seen by the NAACP as not the perfect litigant to tackle the bus segregation ordinances. And so she's passed over. But when Mrs. Parks has her defiance and refuses to leave her seat for a white person and is arrested, the Black community in Montgomery realizes this is perhaps a better face for challenging the movement. And even Rosa Parks is very surprised that her community was able to stick together for more than a year in the boycott. And that, of course, breaks open the whole idea of defying Jim Crow with the strength of the Black community. And out of the Montgomery boycott comes a young 26-year-old pastor in his first pulpit named Martin Luther King Jr.
I want to hold it right there because there's a lot of the story after that, but I want to back up just for a second because Mrs. Septima Clark became a Highlander evangelist and recruiter, and there's a role that the Sea Islands off the coast of South Carolina figure prominently in preparing and training Black people who clung hard and fast to their African roots, languages, and traditions, but ultimately became civil rights activists. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's a wonderful story. And that's where my other character, Esau Jenkins, comes in. Esau Jenkins, born and raised on John's Island, which is an island off the coast of Charleston, one of the Sea Islands, where the Gullah language, a Creole of African and English and other languages, is still used in the 1950s. But most of his neighbors are illiterate and live a subsistence living and are totally unable to get a proper education. And he sees this problem, and he, in his wonderfully creative mind, sets about to change it almost single-handedly at first. He starts a legal defense fund on the island and a community kind of citizens group to advocate for both voter registration and for better living conditions. And one of the most interesting things is he says nothing's going to change until we have political power, and that means being able to vote. But there was such an atmosphere of oppression and suppression of voting that it's hard to break through. To vote or to even attempt to register was very, very dangerous. And he decides he's going to prepare his neighbors. One of his many business ventures is that he runs a little jitney bus service to and from the island to Charleston to bring people who work in the city in the morning and take them home in the afternoon, in the evening. And he has his wife type up the South Carolina Constitution, which is part of what you need to pass the literacy test. You need to be able to not only read it in its very archaic language, but able to interpret it to the satisfaction of this clerk, who, of course, is not going to allow Black people to pass, but it gives them more of a fighting chance if they can read. And so he talks to he gives classes in his bus from the steering wheel in Gullah, and he's talking to them about democracy and political power and the meaning of the Constitution, and he gives them a really great civics lesson, and then he goes with them to try to register at the local courthouse, where it's only open like 2 days a month, and he realizes he needs more to bring his community, enable them to vote in greater numbers. And he goes to the Highlander Folk School for a workshop at the urging of Septima Clark, who has been there a few months before, and tells them about his bus and about how he needs more support to run a school, to really be able to teach literacy. And this is where Mrs. Clark, who has been fired by the NAACP and goes to work as a staff member at Highlander, begins to work with him and Miles Horton to develop this idea of citizenship schools.
Oh, let's hold it right there. Hold it right there, mm-hmm. Because citizenship schools is where we want to pick up in just a second. My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's the author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. So talk about the grocery store.
Yes. So the first citizenship school is organized in the back of a cooperative grocery store that Esau Jenkins and Septima Clark buy with Highlander's help. And the Islanders themselves rehab it and put shelves and a proper grocery store in front. And in behind the shelves is a secret room with no windows. And as Septima Clark said, we built it that way so white people wouldn't know what we were doing. Because just as it was illegal to teach enslaved people to read and write, it was still very dangerous to be teaching Black citizens in the 1950s to read and write in order to vote. And so they keep these secret. And the first teacher is this beautician, Bernice Robinson, who's never taught a class before, protests that she only has a high school education. She can't possibly do this. And Septima Clark and Esau Jenkins and Miles Horton convince her that she's really the right person. She has a vivacious personality. She understands the Islanders. She grew up in Charleston. And they convince her to be the first teacher. And so she goes about it teaching them first how to hold a pencil, because most of them have never had to write with a pencil. They didn't know how. And to be able to sign your name becomes this transformative act, because they no longer have to rely on the banker or their boss or their landlord to sign things for them. And when they begin to learn their letters, they can read and know that if they're being cheated, they learn basic arithmetic. They also learn their rights. They learn the U.S. Constitution. It's pinned up on the wall. And they learn that they are American citizens and they have the right to free association and to vote. And this transforms them. It does what Septima Clark calls being ready from within. They're spiritually ready and they're politically ready, besides having these new skills of literacy. And it really changes them as people. And then Esar Jenkins organizes them into voter leagues and citizens clubs, and they begin to understand that they can approach their elected officials because they now vote. And so it really transforms the political atmosphere on these little sea islands, which have been neglected for centuries. And then it spreads to Charleston, and then it begins to spread into Georgia. In fact, Hosea Williams asked for citizenship schools for his organization in Savannah, and they spread quickly.
And so there are many of them all across the areas of the country.
They're in the South. They're in the 11 southern states, and it is all about both registering and understanding what your rights, understanding the importance of desegregation. Because, of course, what we know is that the Brown decision may have been decided, but there was no timetable, there was no enforcement, and there was massive resistance in the southern states. And so desegregation does not happen by itself, and it doesn't happen for more than a decade in many areas of the South. So they're still having to fight on every level for equality. But with these citizenship schools, there were more than 900 of them established. Now, they're not brick and mortar schools. Don't think they're like a little brick edifice that we think of as a school. They are community classes, peer-to-peer. Volunteer teachers who could be domestic workers, they could be retired teachers, they could be beauticians or funeral parlor directors.
They were just lay people. Volunteer. We have about 2 minutes, so I'm going to skip ahead real quick. But these schools proliferated across the South, but there was also an influence of the Highlander School on the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There was music that it infused into the civil rights movement. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Music was always a big part of the Highlander ethos. Again, singing together, blending your voices gives a sense of strength and unity and purpose. And so it was part of the Highlander curriculum. And one song comes to Highlander in the 1940s by striking women at a tobacco factory in Charleston. And it comes from a Black hymn, and it's difficult to sing, but they used it on the picket line. And Zilphia Horton, Miles Horton's wife, is a trained musician, and she tweaks it and makes it easier to sing. It's sung every night at Highlander for years, and she teaches it to her friend Pete Seeger, who takes it northward and sings it in the coffee houses in the north. And it's called We Shall Overcome. And that becomes the anthem of the movement. And it is taught to the young students like John Lewis, who come to Highlander and who learn about discuss strategy. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is really born out of a meeting at Highlander. And singing becomes really important. And there's a staff folk singer who goes out and teaches this in the citizenship schools, teaches freedom songs, is at all the mass meetings, is helping galvanize the movement through song, which is used both as a comfort and a challenge and a sense of unity. So singing becomes very important, and Highlander is a big part of
that. And we're going to have to leave it there. Oh, my word. Unfortunately, I run out of time. But Elaine, I personally feel that your book should be required reading in every school, in every church, in every university, by every civic group. I'm going to use it to teach my own children. And finally, what do you want readers to take away from this book? 30 seconds.
I want readers to realize that change comes from ordinary people. It doesn't necessarily come from charismatic leaders. It comes from a changing of heart and mind and a dedication to a democratic ideal. These are the most patriotic defenders of democracy I can imagine. And I think at this moment, it's really important to remember that they stood up, they resisted, and they made clear that to be a democracy is to allow all people, all of our citizens, to vote and to participate in their government. So I think it brings a message that is really important today, besides being a tribute to their role in history.
And this happened, a lot of this happened in my lifetime. Thank you for writing this book, Elaine.
Thank you so much for having me on.
My guest was Elaine Weiss, author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. I'm Mike Green.